Excusez-moi, je dois parler en anglais parce que mon français, c'est la langue des touristes. La bière ou de croissant, où est le Ponce d'Avignon, ou qui est la première dame de France. Donc, surveillance medicine and the temporal dimension. And I want to start with looking at how medicine changed 200 years ago. At the very end of the 18th century, the medicine was one of symptoms. Patients would go to the doctor and they'd describe their symptoms. They had a pain, they had a cough, and the words would come out their mouth and the doctor would try and classify them into different diagnoses. That was the basis of medicine. There was no examination of the body, there was no autopsy because there was nothing to find, because illness was something that went around the body. At the very end of the 18th century, as Michel Foucault has told us in Naissance de la Clinique, there was the birth of the clinic in English, there was a shift in that, which said the symptoms did not just come from this illness moving around the body, but they came from a pathology. They came from a particular lesion, a problem inside the body, and it was the symptoms you had to translate what was the underlying cause, what was the pathology making the diagnosis. And medicine at that period in Paris discovered signs, so the doctor could examine the patient and uncover all these signs which would allow a diagnosis to be made. And this was the new pathological medicine, which has dominated medicine throughout the world for the last 200 years. A way of thinking about illness, what the patient says, what the doctor can discover, and they put them together to make a diagnosis of a pathology inside the human body. And this triumph of the clinical gaze, in English we translate Foucault's Le Regard, the clinical gaze, as the clinical gaze. It's the way that doctors would look at the medical problem. And that was also represented by a change in the nature of death. So in the 18th century, death was a natural event, that the figure on the right came to say, the end of your life has come, knocking on the door of life to say, it is time to take you away. So that was a natural event, and this was replaced by a pathological event. So now death is caused by a pathology inside the human body. So when I die, they must make some sort of description of my cause of my death to put on the death certificate, which will be a pathology. In England, I'm not allowed to die from natural causes. I don't know if it's possible in France, but I cannot die from natural causes. You can't put that on the death certificate. You must put on the pathology. Did I die from cancer or a heart attack or an infection? That must go on the death certificate. This shift in the way of thinking and moving from a natural death to a pathological death took about 100 years. And late in the 19th century in England, it was possible to find on the death certificate that people had died from atrophy, from debility, natural causes. Old age was very common. People would die from old age. Not possible now, but it was possible then. And this continued until the end of the 19th century. And now we have replaced natural death with pathological death, except maybe there will be occasions in your life when natural death will be around the corner. This triumph of the clinical gaze, of this way of thinking about illness that Foucault describes, was one of linking the surface of the patient, what the patient said, what the doctor could feel by palpating, by feeling the skin, by trying to discover what was inside the body, using the stethoscope. This was the surface to try and infer what was underneath, what was underlying it, which was the pathological lesion. And this pathological lesion existed in the volume of the human body. So it was the concentration on the human body, in the hospital bed, using clinical examination techniques to discover what was the exact nature of the pathology, because once that diagnosis had been made, then you could follow with treatment. So this was a cross-sectional technique. It was a moment when the doctor brought together all the signs, symptoms, their knowledge, to make a diagnosis of what the patient's problem was. Transversal technique. But at the end of the 19th century, in fact, a new dimension emerged, and that's what my talk is about something new that came into clinical medicine to begin to transform it. And that transformation was what has been called the fourth dimension, or the temporal dimension. And it was popularized by spiritualists at the end of the 19th century, when people were having seances to try and connect with spirits. They talked about connecting with the fourth dimension, because the spirits existed in the fourth dimension. At the very end of the century, the fourth dimension came to be represented by time. It was the temporal dimension. And I've shown you on the bottom here, Google Ngrams is a very useful tool which Google provides. They have been scanning books throughout the world, and they've now 5 million, 6 million books have been scanned, and they all can be searched by the word. So this graph represents the occurrence of the word in Google Ngrams, of the words the fourth dimension, which is the blue line, and you can see that it increases from the very beginning of the 20th century, increases to a maximum about 1920 and then is in decline, whereas the temporal dimension increases from the 1930s onwards, starts to increase rapidly. We have a similar pattern in French, because Google has also scanned some French books, international, and so you can search for French terms in Google, in Ngrams. And so here we have a very similar pattern. We have le quatrième dimension reaching a peak in about 1920 and then flattening. And we have this idea, la dimension temporelle arising in about the 1930s, 1940s, and taking off. Very similar to the English language equivalents and the shift over that period. And now for audience participation. This is an Englishman, a German, and a Frenchman. And I will first ask you to identify the Frenchman on the extreme right. Anybody? Who is it? No, not Pasteur. I am shocked. I am very... No, it is Émile Durkheim, a very famous Frenchman. I think he's brilliant, but clearly you don't. The one in the middle, perhaps you should ask Suzanne. Who's the one in the middle? Einstein. And the one on the extreme left, who I didn't know, so I won't expect you to know, is an Englishman, and his name is H.G. Wells. And in 1895, he produced a book, a novel, called The Time Machine. You might not have read the novel, but you perhaps have seen the films. There have been several films of this. And this was the first science fiction book to suggest that time was a linear process which you could travel along. You could move forward and you could move back. The first time that idea enters the world is in 1895 by H.G. Wells, who I think of the three has the best haircut, if I might say. And then, a few years later, in 1905, in 1916, Einstein produces his special theory and general theory of relativity, where he said time is the fourth dimension. He took this spiritualist idea and he says, no, it is another dimension, like space, physical three-dimensional space, we can add another dimension, which is the fourth dimension. And within the same period, we have Durkheim, who's got the worst hairstyle because he has no hair, he produced his book, The Elementary Forms of the Religious Life, in 1912, in which he said the ideas of time, space, class, cause, and personality are constructed out of social elements. So three different views of the nature of time emerging entirely independently in the novel, in physics, and in sociology, all within 10, 20 years of each other. So time becomes important, an important dimension, a concept, construct, at the beginning of the 20th century. And so what I want to do in this talk is explore how this new idea, which I'm suggesting emerged at the beginning of the 20th century, this concept of time, of the temporal dimension, how it began to move into clinical medicine, particularly in the 1930s, It appeared in clinical medicine. I want to look at two examples here, that is chronic illness and screening. And then by the 1960s, in the post-war world, time began to underform a new form of medicine, which I've called surveillance medicine, and this replaced the clinical gaze. The clinical gaze, which had dominated medicine for 2 centuries, for 200 years, began to decline. And I think it is still declining and eventually will disappear. And this new form of medicine will take over. So let me look at how time came into medicine, how it first came into medicine in the 1930s. And I would suggest it came in two main areas, two ideas which incorporated time. One was the idea of chronic illness, the other, the idea of screening for early disease. If we again look at n-grams, Google n-grams, to look at the terms chronic disease and chronic illness in English, we see this interesting pattern. From about the 1930s, both chronic disease and chronic illness both increase quite dramatically. But there is this period in the 19th century when there's no chronic illness, but there is chronic disease. And that is because there is a distinction in the English words between illness. Illness is what the patient experiences, the patient feels ill, and disease is what the doctor diagnoses. So the doctor can say, you have a disease, and the patient feels well, feels healthy, has good health. But the doctor says, you have a disease, and sometimes the patient feels ill, but the doctor says, you have no disease. So disease is what the doctor says, illness is what the patient experiences. And it's an important distinction in English, because if we look at the French, it's not so good, I'm afraid, because you have maladie chronique in French books. I'm sure the Académie Française will not allow you to use additional English words like disease and illness, but you can see the pattern there is not very clear, but the pattern in English books is very clear. There is disease in the 19th century, and then suddenly in the 20th century, there's both disease and illness, chronic forms take place. So what's happening here? What's happening in the 19th century with chronic disease? What do we mean, what did doctors understand by chronic disease in the 19th century in the context of this clinic? And what I want to suggest is that chronic disease is in the box in the bottom corner there, is a lesion, is a pathology with a long time course. It goes over a long period of time, and therefore it was very difficult to diagnose. So a patient would go to the doctor and they say, I have a cough. Now, is that tuberculosis, a very early part of tuberculosis? Because usually with tuberculosis, you must cough up blood, le sang. Yeah, you must cough up blood, and that is a sign of tuberculosis. So you've got to work out where in this timeline of the disease was the patient presenting to the doctor. So the symptoms and signs would vary according to when in the disease the problem was occurring. So many medical books in the 19th century describe chronic disease, and they mainly describe it as a problem of diagnosis because of the unstable symptoms and unstable signs. There wasn't a classical picture, this is the disease, because the picture varied over time. So this was the 19th century idea of chronic disease. But as I've said, in the 20th century, chronic disease increasingly becomes this idea of chronic illness. And I want to suggest there are two processes at work, which I will describe. The first process is to see disease as in terms of its impact on the patient, that something was happening to the patient, and medicine began to describe the patient's experience rather than simply the disease pathology. And the second force, the influence in the development of chronic illness, was the idea of aging, which had been part of the natural process, like death. People age, you know, I have my hair drops out, I have white hair, I have wrinkles, I'm very old, and that is a natural process. But medicine will come in and begin to tell me that this is not natural, that this is pathological, and therefore it becomes a medical problem rather than a problem of nature. And we'll see how this was influenced the chronic illness in the 20th century. So first, looking at disease as a disabling disease, it's affecting the patient. Early in the 20th century, chronic illness becomes to describe the effect of disease on the patient. And they describe, the doctors describe in medical journals, they describe the patient as disabled over a long period. So a patient who has disability has a chronic illness. And so we have these two terms. Chronic disease is a characteristic of the pathology, whereas chronic illness is the effect of the chronic disease on the patient. So this separation of this construct into disease and illness. And eventually in the 20th century, and now, they're often used interchangeably in English. So sometimes people will talk about chronic illness, but they mean chronic disease. They talk about chronic disease, but they mean chronic illness. But they mean chronic illness as in something that's affecting the patient. So it's possible to have a chronic illness that has no effect, that has no symptoms on the patient. And the second shift is the movement to colonize the last remaining vestiges of natural time. So there was time in the body. People grew, born, grew old, developed, got old and died. There was that natural process, which was described as a natural process of decay. As people got older, their organs failed, their skin fails, their hair falls out. Things happen as you get older, and this was the natural decay. In the 1930s, 40s, medicine began to relabel this degeneration, not as degeneration, but as degenerative disease. And later, this degenerative disease became labeled as chronic illness. And a very good illustration of this, I think, is heart disease, which is the great disease of the 20th century. It's now disappearing. Heart disease is disappearing very quickly. And I guess the new century will have diseases of livers, or if the French win, or kidneys if the Americans win. So we'll see. So what happened in the 1920s? First of all, there were two types of heart disease recognized. And when they wrote about people having heart disease, sometimes they said, well, you've got heart disease because you're old. It's inevitable that you will have heart disease when you're old, because when you're old, your heart starts to fail. It's not good heart, it's a bad heart when you get old, and therefore it will affect everyone. We can't avoid it. But there are some people who have a pathology, who have heart disease. It looks exactly the same as in the old, but because it's in the young, it's a pathology, and we should treat it. Because we can treat it, we can avoid it, it's pathological. And then in the 1930s, they start to say, well, both young and old have the same disease. It's degenerative heart disease, and now 1950s and the last 60 years, we say everyone has heart disease of a pathological form. So there's no distinction between a heart disease in someone aged 40 or someone aged 60. It's the same heart disease which medicine can treat, can try and prevent, can stop you dying from heart disease. So that shift in seeing heart disease as a problem essentially of aging, natural, changed during the middle of the 20th century. And here's an illustration of this in JAMA, which is the Journal of the American Medical Association. Every week they have a column, well, I don't know if they still have it, but they used to have a column of obituaries of American doctors. So they'd report a American doctor who died. Whenever a doctor has an obituary, they are always well-loved by their patients. No doctor was ever hated by their patient. They were always loved by their patients. But in the obituary, they gave the cause of death. So what I looked at in JAMA, because it's word searchable, I looked at, in the obituaries, what was the causes of death over the 20th century. And you can see that this deaths from myocardial degeneration peaked in about 1940, is it? Was quite common in the 1950s, and by the 1970s had just about disappeared. So a significant cause of death for the whole population and for doctors in that middle of the 20th century just disappeared. And the last doctor to die from myocardial degeneration was in 1972. It was called Dr. John Connor, which if you've seen the Terminator films, is a bit strange because it was John Connor. Anyway, the last doctor to die from myocardial degeneration was John Connor in 1972. So all those patients who died from myocardial degeneration, what did they really die from? Well, they died from aging. They died from old age. but medicine had colonized this and said, you cannot die from old age, you must die from myocardial degeneration. And after the 1970s, you would die from myocardial infarction. You'd die from a pathology rather than a degenerative disease. So chronic illness, which then appeared in the middle of the 20th century, was required different diagnostic techniques to capture it. It was no good. You couldn't capture it with examining the patient's body. You couldn't capture it with a stethoscope. You couldn't capture it with the clinical examination. You had to have additional tools. These new clinical tools came into medicine, things like the survey. There were lots of surveys of people's ability, disabilities in the US and Britain. Prevention became very important because if a disease has a timeline, then you can identify it early and prevent its later progress. Ideas of continuity of care, which are very important today, emerged at that time. Long-term surveillance of illness, and the idea of screening. Now, screening, too, embodies this idea that you can look at illness over a period of time and attack it at the very beginning. So we have screening at the 1920s. There's two forms of screening emerge. This is a study I've just done which reports from US, from American data. Screening for tuberculosis and screening in the school health examination were two forms of screening. And what's characteristic about this screening? Why was it different from the old clinical examination? First of all, it was concerned with early diagnosis. These patients had nothing wrong with them or overtly wrong with them. Yeah, they had hidden disease. So the idea was you must diagnose things very early on. You must examine normal populations because it is in normal populations you will find tuberculosis that no one knows about the tuberculosis in normal populations. And also, it was focused on diseases which had social impact. So it was tuberculosis because it could be transferred to other people. It was in schools because the children would grow up and to be adults and they would be damaged by the disease. And later it was in things like venereal disease, which again was a social problem. So those three characteristics of the diseases selected for screening in the 1920s. And the idea behind screening, as I've said, the disease has a timeline. There is a time before disease, and of course there is a time after disease. And therefore we need new techniques for monitoring patients and healthy populations. And this resulted in a transformation of that cross-sectional clinical gaze, because what they had to do is identify early illness and monitor patients over time. Screening is about monitoring patients over time along this timeline. World War II was extended, screening was extended to venereal disease and mental functioning. It thought this was important for the military, that they had to know whether they had venereal disease or they had good mental functioning. In the 1950s, after the war, the doctor said, well, why don't we identify all disease early? This is a way of thinking about illness we haven't considered before. Let's identify all disease early and prevent it. And so this emerged in the 1950s, this surveillance dream. And you can see in the editorials and in the articles that doctors publish at this period, they are very excited about this new idea of identifying all disease very early on, treating it, so therefore you eliminate disease. If you can manage to prevent everything, there will be no more disease left. So this became the disease of the dream of medicine, la rêve de médecine. So disease prevention, the idea of multiphasic screening. If you're screening somebody for one disease, why not screen them for two, three, four, five, six diseases all at the same time? That's what multiphasic screening. Population screening, let's get the population. Before, it was individual patients came to healthcare. Now healthcare would go out to the whole population and screen them all. And so this was the big surveillance dream of the 1950s. It didn't last. In the 1970s, a series of problems began to emerge in screening, which I think has stopped it. And it is slowing down, and I think will stop. And first of all, the problem is false positives and false negatives. When you examine the data, there are some patients who you say have the disease, and really they don't. And some people you say they're healthy, and in fact they have the disease. We also believe that screening causes harms. It causes psychological harms. People get very anxious when they're screened. They get very anxious when they get false positives and so on. And a lot of patients refuse to go to screening. They're invited, but they decline to attend the screening process. There was recently, in the United States, there was a debate about breast cancer screening, mammography for breast cancer, and there was such a debate about whether they should stop it, whether they should continue, and it was called the mammographic wars in the United States, because there's a big debate about should you continue doing breast cancer screening. In England now, there is a lot of serious questions about whether this program should continue because of the harms, potential harms, it does to women, and the benefits seem to be relatively small. So what happened in the 1970s, as screening went into decline, this population screening went into decline, a new form of screening emerges, which is opportunistic screening based on a risk factor approach. And this is much more efficient than the old one, because the patient comes to see the doctor, and whatever they come with a cough. You say, forget the cough, I must measure your blood pressure and your cholesterol and your weight. I must do all these other measurements. And they said, but I came with my cough. No, but we're going to look at your risk factor profile. So it becomes less easy for the patient to resist, for the patient to say no. And eventually, we move into a process of self-screening. If only we can persuade patients to screen themselves with pedometers or monitors, check their own blood sugar and diabetes, check their own blood pressure with hypertension. We can persuade patients to screen themselves. So the whole idea of screening shifts from populations to individuals to a much more personalized self-surveillance opportunistic screening. And just to show that risk factors, this concept of a risk factor, which is very important for this new form of screening, the risk factor emerges in 1961 in medicine. There's the idea of a risk factor. In ecology, the risks from pollution in the natural world emerge in the early 1960s. We know that if we burn out too much carbon, we damage the climate. If we do things to the environment, we will damage our health. Everything around us now is a risk factor. You know, there's cosmic rays coming in through this ceiling, which are affecting me as I speak. You might have noticed. So in the early 1960s, the whole idea of a risk factor, and you can see this term, becomes much more common in the closing decades of the 20th century. Becomes a very commonly used term, because medicine gets dominated by not the signs of pathology, but the idea of a risk factor. And so this brings together a new form of medicine, surveillance medicine, I've called it, but it could be called risk factor medicine, a new form of medicine that relies on the surveillance of patients and populations to replace the cross-sectional techniques of the classical diagnosis. So instead of that, the model of medicine being that moment when the doctor stands at the patient's bed and makes a diagnosis, instead of having that, we now have this surveillance, much more a long period of time where the doctor is working. So we have new techniques for screening for risk factors. We have the new problem of chronic illness, which is everywhere. Everyone has a little bit of it. It becomes more common as you get old. But lots of older people have two or three, four chronic illnesses. There's a new focus on events outside the body because it isn't the pathology. The risk factors, well, cholesterol is a risk factor, but it's your diet that's the risk factor. It's your behaviors which are the risk factors. And there's new models of multidimensional causes. The whole nature of cause changes from being a single event, one event causing another, to being lots of different events causing a particular problem. And so if we look at the old model of the clinic, which, as I said, was the pathology inside the human body, the signs and the symptoms producing a diagnosis, what happens is we now have this new timeline dominating medicine where we look at risk factors that are producing this pathology, which becomes less important because it is simply another manifestation of a risk factor. The risk factors in particular produce symptoms. We're much more concerned with symptoms, what the patient says, than what we find inside the body now. And we have these downstream effects of the symptoms. Disability is what the patient reports as the problem with the disease. So we look downstream. So that blue line then represents the new medicine, which is about a timeline which requires medical surveillance. So we have a timeline along the bottom. And here we have, again, I like Google n-grams, but here we have timeline, wonderful English word, takes off in the 1960s, 1970s, and now we talk about timelines all the time. Unfortunately, the French don't talk about it as much. They talk about chronology. Is that the same? Is that translation? Yes. So it's not as clear. So I only use the data that supports my argument. So this is a timeline. So we have death of the clinic. Disease illness has a temporal dimension. We have a new surveillance medicine. And therefore, because the old clinic is disappearing, we must reorganize it. We must think again about how we conduct the old clinical medicine. There must be changes in the way we do things. And so clinical practice, healthcare adopts a temporal strategy. And over the last 20, 30 years, in all our countries, we have ideas about early detection, risk factor management, screening, continuity of care, appointment systems, anticipatory care, comprehensive care, clinical records, stage theories, and so on. If you look in the literature, there's lots of these phenomena which are underpinned by time, by the temporal dimension. And we have a new narrative also emerges in the 1970s. How do you explain where does all this chronic illness come from, this new temporalizing of illness? And we have this thing called the epidemiological transition. The epidemiologists will tell you this is their story, their narrative. They say chronic disease emerged after defeat of acute illness and with an aging population. So they explain it with this new narrative, which we all believe, because that's what they tell us. Michel Foucault, in his La Naissance de la Clinique, said, "It is not because he falls ill that a man may die, but because he might die that he falls ill." In other words, death is the most important aspect of the old clinic. That the moment of death, because the pathology causes you to die, from that pathology, everything else flows. You must identify the pathology that causes death. So if the old clinic is disappearing, then we must reorganize death. Yeah? We cannot have the old death that belonged to the old clinic. We must have a new forms of death. And in the 1960s, first of all, autopsy results become unreliable. There's a lot of articles, papers in the journal saying that they are unreliable. What you find on autopsy doesn't quite fit with what has been found in the clinic. Or different pathologists conducting an autopsy will come up with different results. So there's a whole doubting about whether these autopsy results are worthwhile. And at the same time, and independently, there are a group of psychologists and psychiatrists and physicians who talk about a new way of death, which is about dying. And they talk about people anticipating their own death and grieving. Yeah? So for thousands of years, when you die, the people who mourn, who grieve for you, are your relatives and friends. Now, the main mourner is yourself. You must mourn, grieve your own death before it occurs. So we can now have this great reversal where instead of other people mourning your death, you mourn your own death. And the medical profession can have confessions from you about how you're feeling and how you're feeling angry and how you're in denial. They can demand confessions of the dying. They can identify these stages of dying as you go through these stages, as you adjust to the dying process, and very much seeing dying as a process. So medicine becomes dominated less by the moment of death, which anyway we don't know any longer when somebody dies, because there is organ death, there's brain death, there is tissue death, there are all sorts of different deaths. There isn't any longer a moment of death caused by a pathology. So instead, we have a new emphasis on the process of dying. So 1960s, all these things happened. When they coalesced, they came together in this new surveillance medicine. We have risk factors appearing, we have time investing medicine, and the stages of dying all come together at this same moment of time. And it's also ironic, coincidental, interesting, that Foucault published his book, Naissance de la Clinique, about the old medicine at the very moment when it was dying. When the old medicine was finishing, he wrote his book about the triumph of a clinical gaze, of a le regard, which was to dominate clinical medicine for 200 years, but was actually finishing. So this is curious that he should write his book at the end of this epoch, when it is finishing. So I leave you with the thought is, what is time? Does time exist, or has it only recently been invented? Timelines and temporal, it seems to me, a recent phenomenon. And I think I've got a fine, in case there are any questions, to say, why is this occurring? I say the answer, you must go to your priest or your historian to find the answer to this, because I cannot give you the answer, because I go back to Durkheim, and he said the ideas of time, space, class, and cause are socially developed. And so nowadays we know in the 1960s we have a multifactorial, multi-causal theories now dominate our explanations of phenomena. So when you ask me what caused something, I must give you a different answer today than the one I did 50 years ago, because the cause is bound up with the paradigm. It is part of the episteme by which we think. So the end of my talk, thank you for listening. The paper we mentioned at the beginning, Rise of Surveillance Medicine, and there's two more recent papers, one on screening and one on chronic illness, which I'm happy to share with people if anybody wanted to see them. Okay, thank you very much.